Kim Jong-un is apparently suicidal, which, you know, on a personal level, as an individual, wouldn't really bother me at all. Like, if that's how he feels, great. The problem is he's trying to take a hemisphere of this planet with him, apparently, by launching missiles again and again and again. This latest one, more provocative than any that has come before. We're going to get into it later in the show. Also want to talk about Senator Amy Klobuchar, who has found, you know, it's been a while since Klobuchar has been in the news for a policy that she's trying to advance, but it always fits the same mold. Some nice, safe issue that there's actually no other side of, right? Like, you know, her pool drain thing. Like, nobody's for kids dying in swimming pools, right? That's the issue that she decides she's going to champion. Has no political courage whatsoever. We've got the latest example of a Klobuchar special come to you later this hour as well. Or next hour, actually, later in the show. I want to talk about the status of the GOP tax plan. There's been drama. It's been going back and forth. You know, as has happened before in these legislative scenarios, the article that I read at the beginning of my prep for the program ends up contradicting an article that I read towards the end of my prep for the program, because these situations are constantly in flux when it comes to making the legislative sausage. So we'll analyze that for you later in the program as well. And before we get to any of that, though, we got to plow through all the latest in sexual harassment, sexual assault, sexual misconduct land. And also, I want to start off the show this evening talking about this Pocahontas remark, but not, you know, not in the way that you've probably heard it talked about all day long. I want to ask a specific question, an introspective question directed at us, at you and at me. And the question is this, it's about language. What do we mean when we call somebody a snowflake? What does that mean? You know, because this is a term that has been popularized in the public discourse. And it's wielded by both sides. It's wielded by the left and the right. You know, I think it emerged. I think if you trace it in recent history in the discourse, it emerged in being directed towards college students on the leftist side of the political spectrum for being special little snowflakes. And we can dig into that etymology a little bit. But in terms of the because it's thrown back and forth. Of, oh, you're a snowflake because you're offended by this. No, you're a snowflake because you're offended by that. What are we talking about? Is there a there, or is this just a useless term that has no actual meaning other than identifying somebody as having been offended by something? And if that's the case, then what's the point? Closing Argument is the name of the program. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can join us and give your answer to those questions and chime in on any of the topics we discussed tonight by calling 651-989-5855. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the program for us this evening. So, you know, in case you somehow missed this, here's the summary from the Star Tribune. Families of Native American war veterans and politicians of both major parties are criticizing President Donald Trump for using a White House event honoring Navajo code talkers to take a political jab at a Democratic senator he has nicknamed Pocahontas. The Republican president on Monday turned to the name he often deployed for Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren during the 2016 presidential campaign to mock her claims about being part Native American. He told the three Navajo code talkers on stage that he had affection for them that he doesn't have for her. It was uncalled for, said Marty Thompson, whose great uncle was a Navajo code talker. He can say what he wants when he's out doing his presidential business among his people, but when it comes to honoring veterans or any kind of people, he needs to grow up and quit saying things like that. Now, I want to pause there to identify what this Marty Thompson is actually saying here. What's being appealed to here? This concept of context. Time, place, manner. Time, place, manner. Context matters. You know, there are things that you can say. There are things that you do say in a context like, I don't know, a Friday night, 11:30, after a few beers with the folks that you watched a football game with or whatever the case may be. There are things that are said and done in that context that would not be appropriate when you're dropping your kid off at school on Monday morning, right? Or when you're in church on Sunday morning, or whatever the case may be. Or, you know, when you're putting your kids to bed at night. Like, there are different contexts where certain statements and certain actions are less appropriate than in other contexts. And that's the real issue here. I think part of what people are getting hung up on, and the reason why we have to go through this analysis of the term snowflake and what it actually means, is because folks are latching onto the Pocahontas term itself. You know, this epithet that Trump has taken on and utilized against Elizabeth Warren, which, you know, look, to date, I've never had a problem with. Like, generally speaking, I don't think it's, especially in the context, speaking of context, in the context of her having apparently falsely assumed a ethnicity, a background that she doesn't actually have in order to benefit her career. Like, in that context, mocking her a little bit for it makes sense to me, right? But it's the idea that completely out of the blue, like, there was no provocation for it. There was no justification for it. There was no reason to pivot to it. It was like from just like a social, and I know this is a difficult concept for us to grasp nowadays, but just from like a basic, like, social appropriateness standpoint, it was not the right time, place, or manner to make this kind of comment.
It's just like when he used his speech to the Boy Scouts and made it into a campaign event. He just takes it and makes it about himself, or tries to get some little jab in there,
right,
that takes it too far.
Right. And you know, that's the thing. And this Marty Thompson, in the article here from the Star Tribune, you know, articulates that. You know, he says he can say, speaking of Trump, he can say what he wants when he's out doing his presidential business among his people. In other words, when he's out on the campaign trail, you know, when he's out having a rally, whatever the case may be. But when it comes to honoring veterans or any kind of people, he needs to grow up and quit saying things like that. I think that's a fair point. Other people think it makes him a snowflake. So I'm asking you, what does that mean? Let's go to Scott in Otsego. Welcome to the program, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Walter.
Yep.
So I got a feeling that our culture has become one that is so wrapped up in political correctness and then with the onset of everybody tweeting and texting and emojis, and they've taken all the beauty out of the language, but at the same time, they're so afraid to say what they really mean. That these terms like snowflake, and Pocahontas or anything, it's just an easy way for people to really say what they want to say, but they're afraid of it with political correctness, if you're following my logic here.
Yeah, no, I understand. Like, I feel as though, you know, going back and analyzing the 2016 campaign in retrospect, I think a big part of what everybody missed, myself included, absolutely 100%, is that it was, I think, first and foremost, a backlash against political correctness in concept. Like, people are sick and tired of being told that the thing they said, or worse yet, the thing that they believe or the identity that they hold is somehow inherently offensive. And I get that. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's hard to have a conversation with somebody when you're constantly being cut down for what you feel or believe in.
Right. Yeah, I appreciate it.
You don't know how to frame it correctly.
Right. All right, Scott, I appreciate your comments. Thanks for calling in the program. So what I want to challenge you with, though, on that, because, you know, acknowledging, like, political correctness is a real problem, right? But why is it a real problem? It's a problem to the extent that, and only to the extent that, it is irrational. When you start, like, to my mind, you go back to that etymology, where did this term come from? You know, snowflake, a special little snowflake directed at college students who get offended by everything on the university campus today. What that's acknowledging, or what that's alluding to, is this tendency, this generational raising of kids with the belief that they should never have to encounter any sort of challenge, right? Like of any variety, even in terms of like a rhetorical challenge or a challenge to their thought process. And based on this notion that they are inherently special, that there's something about them that absolves them from the consequences of living that the rest of us have to endure. You know, and it creates a double standard whereby you have to just take whatever they throw at you. But the moment that you play tit for tat and point out something, you're critical of them in any way, you've committed some sort of, you know, unnamed crime against them. That is a problem. And I think it's proper to refer to such people as snowflakes. When somebody gets offended by something that rationally, logically, they should not be offended by, like there is no rational case for why that ought to be offensive, then the term snowflake has some weight to it. But what I see happening in the discourse right now, particularly surrounding this whole Navajo co-talker event and the Pocahontas remark, is the notion that if you're offended by literally anything at all, then you're a snowflake, right? Now, I've been kind of trying to conjure up, you know, what are some analogies that we could use to try to demonstrate this point? And, you know, it's tough to come up with a good, you know, apples to apples comparison. But just imagine that somebody came into your house, right? And they started making fun of your wife or your kids, you know, or they came in and they said something about your background, your heritage, whatever the case may be, like in your house. Or, you know, maybe a better apples-to-apples comparison would be at your kid's graduation ceremony or something along those lines. The point being that, again, time, place, and manner. You're in a location and you're in a context, you're in circumstances where the focus is properly supposed to be on one thing, and out of nowhere, for no rational reason, you bring up something that's inherently provocative and rationally offensive to the very people who are supposed to be being honored. This shouldn't be too difficult to understand why that would be a problem. And to call somebody a snowflake for being offended in that context is to dismiss the entire concept of being offended by anything at all. And at that point, we might as well all pack up and go home. Because if nobody ever has any basis for ever being offended, then what's the point of any of this? What's the point of the discourse at all? What is it that we're trying to drive at? If there aren't a certain set of values and ideas and conduct that is right as opposed to something else which is wrong, then what are we fighting over? Closing argument. My name is Walter Hatson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I mean, it seems as though we've gotten to the point where, for some folks, the idea is that you can't ever be offended by anything. And that if you ever get upset by something that somebody says or does, then you are a snowflake. There is something, it demonstrates a flaw in your character if you take offense to something. And I think that this is an overreaction to the politically correct culture, which properly ought to be opposed. And I think, you know, we're living in a moment where the ascendancy of Donald Trump and the Donald Trump presidency stands as a rebuke of the politically correct culture that has creeped its way into our public discourse over the past couple of decades. But that said, you know, in order to appropriately defeat something that is wrong, like political correctness, you have to first identify what it is. And once you identify what it is, then you take actions to counter what it actually is. You don't just turn it around and fight proverbial fire with fire, because that doesn't actually solve the problem. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hatson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. The Independent Journal Review has a piece about this. They note that one of the Navajo code talkers who was at the ceremony that has caused all this hubbub, where President Donald Trump referred to Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas completely without any sort of like lead-in. Like there was no catalyst for it. He just out of the blue decided he was going to make this comment. A Joshua Green, who is a CNN political analyst, met Thomas Begay,
who was one of the Navajo code talkers in question, at the airport and asked him about the Pocahontas comment. Begay said he was puzzled but not offended by Trump's remarks and said, the Marines made us yell Geronimo when we jumped out of planes, and that didn't offend me either. And this, of course, is cited as how wonderful this Thomas Begay is because he's not a snowflake. He doesn't need a safe space, what have you. Now, listen, I'm on board with the idea that taking something in stride is a good testament to your character. And, you know, for these guys, and, you know, a lot of folks have pointed out that the code talkers, including this Thomas Begay fellow, that they didn't express any sort of shock in the moment, and there wasn't any sort of demonstration of outrage by them. I think the reason, and that does speak to their character, but of course there was. That doesn't mean that it was okay for him to do what he did or say what he said. It just means that they are better people. It means that they took it in stride. It means that they are professionals. And wouldn't it be nice if we were led by somebody who had those qualities as well? Let me give you an example of some real snowflake behavior to give you a little bit of local angle here. By the way, this closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson. From the Star Tribune, the Hennepin County Board on Tuesday gave final approval, as expected, to changing the name of Lake Calhoun, Minneapolis's largest lake, back to its original Dakota name. The board voted 4-3 to change the name to, I'm going to have to ramp up to this one here, Bidet Maka Ska, meaning White Earth Lake. Now, why couldn't they just call it White Earth Lake? I mean, if that's what it means, why? The board ratified the decision made last week on the same vote by a committee of the board. The proposed change now goes to state and federal agencies, which must approve it before it becomes official. Board Chairwoman Jan Callison again offered an amendment to adopt the dual name of Lake Calhoun, Bidet Maka Ska, even though the U.S. Board of Geographic Names, which has the final say, sent a letter saying that dual names for a lake wasn't permitted. The board voted down that amendment. Yeah, you know, we're not going to have hyphenated names for a lake. We're not that dumb yet. We'll get there. Trust me. We're on that trajectory. But no, hyphenated names for a lake, not happening.
We're just going to be like Canada, where they have French names and, well, I guess this is just more Quebec, but like French names and English names and everything.
Right.
And there's an enforced standard for how much French you can use and how much English you can use.
That sounds great. That sounds fantastic. I want to be more like Canada. How about you? Oh, yeah. So this, to my mind, is an example of actually being a snowflake. And by that, I mean that there's no rational basis for being offended by Lake Calhoun. Like, if the biggest problem in your life is that there's a lake somewhere named after a guy who didn't like Native Americans for whatever, if that's your biggest problem in life, let me suggest you have an awesome life. It is fantastic that every other aspect of your existence is put together and totally lined up and functioning perfectly so that the only thing you have left to direct your attention toward is the name of a lake. And the fact that it bothers you so much that you have to inconvenience literally everyone else by changing the name of a lake that they know and have grown up knowing and that generations have known, changing the name of a lake, not to another English name that people can easily adopt and remember and utilize, but to the Dakota name for the lake. That's going to take, you know, I have no idea how long it's going to take for people to properly be able to pronounce.
Two or three generations.
Yeah. I mean, and to not just to pronounce, but to think of it in those terms. Because here's the thing. Here's what the board, the Hennepin County Board of Parks or whatever entity this is, here's what they and all the federal agencies involved, what they can't do through the inofficial action, through casting a vote. They can't change your mind. They can't change your culture.
Well, and as all these steps have proven, they don't have the authority to really change the name.
Right.
Like, it's still going to appear on federal maps as Lake Calhoun.
Sure.
State maps as Lake Calhoun. It's just at the county and local level right now.
Which is absurd. It's going to create problems. And again, you know, the reason why, to my mind, this qualifies as snowflake territory is because it's much ado about literally nothing. And you're causing a real inconvenience to people's lives over something that does not matter at all. And even to the extent that it matters to you personally, you can't quantify that in any objective way that justifies the action that you're prescribing. And that's the kind of thing. And, you know, that's the thing. People see things like this, and that's why, you know, they turn to something like what Trump did today with the whole Pocahontas comment, and they go, you know what, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that because, you know, if people are going to be changing the names of lakes because it's somehow racist or in order to overthrow the patriarchy or the white supremacy or whatever the case may be, if that's the world we've come to where things are that absurd, I think I'm okay with the president making a gaffe. And just to clarify, like, you know, this is, I don't think the guy, we need to impeach him, right? Or that this should affect whether or not you support him politically. I just think it was a bad personal choice. And I think that, you know, perhaps we ought to be honest about what our social standards are, instead of having a completely different one for the president of the United States, as opposed to those that we apply in every other area of our lives, our homes, our workplaces, our schools, our churches. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. One thing that these myriad of sexual misconduct allegations covering, you know, a bipartisan selection of public figures has revealed is the prolific phenomenon of hypocrisy, politically motivated hypocrisy, whereby the other guy, the other team's guy who's been accused of something must resign now, today, at every minute he doesn't. It's an insult to women everywhere, right? But our guy, no, that's totally fine.
There were petitions circulated on Facebook, like those change.org petitions that you always see, like, oh, well, and the position was basically, well, Al Franken's a good guy, and yeah, he apologized. Let's keep him around. Let me sign the petition.
And, of course, on our side, you've got the same thing going on with Roy Moore, right? Which, those two scenarios are fairly similar in the sense that there's substantive evidence in both cases. Both of the accused involved have to one degree or another denied that they engaged in any untoward conduct.
Well, I don't think Al Franken denied it, though. He kind of said, well, I forgot. I'm sorry I acted that way. I didn't realize that's how I was acting. But he I don't think he outright denied it in the same way that Roy Moore did.
He was ambiguous. He obfuscated.
He kind of took the what's it called, the Alford plea, in that I'm not going to admit my guilt, but I realize that the defense might, or the prosecutor might have enough evidence to convict.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. And which, to my mind, for the purposes of the point that I'm trying to make, is basically the same thing. I mean, you know, you're not gonna get point by point, 100% apples to apples comparison on any given accusation or set of accusations that's made. But I certainly think that Franken and Roy Moore are a closer approximation to each other than, say, you know, who's one of, like, Schoen, for instance, who basically admitted, okay, yes, this happened. Or, you know, let's go into outside the world of politics. Louis C.K. is probably a better example. Louis C.K. was like, yep, I did it, and it was wrong, and this is why it was wrong, and, you know, it really reflected upon it and turned it into what I thought was a positive message about owning that kind of thing. The point being that, you know, wherever you find yourself on the political spectrum, whatever side of the political divide you find yourself on, it seems as though there are a large number of folks who are willing to accept conduct in their guy that they are ready to, you know, politically lynch the other guy for, if he did it, if he's on the other team. And that the only real principle involved there, or anything that resembles a principle, is political alignment, political allegiance, team identity, which strikes me as not actually a principle at all. And when I reflect upon, and when we talk about this concept of political correctness and the idea of, you know, accusing each other of being snowflakes for getting offended at things, what occurs to me is the root problem with political correctness, what political correctness actually is it's an attempt to subvertly and with a kind of really insidious malice destroy standards by applying absurd ones, right? You know, so you're going to say, for instance, you know, going back to the Lake Calhoun deal, we're going to change the name of Lake Calhoun because it's offensive to people somehow, some way, for things that happened, you know, 100 years ago or so that have no effect upon our daily lives and that people have gotten by for decades upon decades, generations upon generations, somehow managing to have productive, happy lives in spite of. But it's suddenly a huge problem that we have to do something about. Like that by offering that as an absurd standard, it undermines the concept of having a standard. And on the right, I fear that we've responded to that by basically calling the bluff and saying, all right, we'll just get rid of standards then. I mean, in effect, that seems to be what, you know, when I contemplate a lot of the things that have been said and done by, whether you're talking about Donald Trump or you're talking about Roy Moore or whatever the case may be, you know, these are things that 10, 20 years ago, conservatives would have been unilaterally decrying and saying, you know, this is not acceptable. This is not the way we behave. This is not who we are. But nowadays, it's the actual thing is not defended. And you can see this all over social media. You know, people are like, yeah, probably wasn't a good idea to, and it goes beyond the Pocahontas thing. It probably wasn't a good idea to say or do whatever it is, fill in the blank, the latest gaffe. Probably wasn't a good idea, but I still like him and I still think it's okay because the left is so horrible and political correctness is so bad and we got to fight the left, we got to fight this political correct culture by apparently getting rid of our own standards, which strikes me as rather self-defeating. I don't know how are you going to, you know, like, what's the end game there? Is there a point where you're going to reestablish these standards, or are they just going to be gone forever? And in that case, did they ever matter in the first place? And if so, you know, why did we bother? If they didn't matter, why we bothered to fight for them for decades on end?
Well, conservatives need to start trying to actually control the dialogue instead of just reacting to it. That might be hard because obviously there's more liberals in society than conservatives. But when people enforce political correctness or claim offense at something, they're not advancing a point. They're just using the unwritten rules of social norms to try to control the dialogue. Because suddenly it's not about the point that you made.
Right.
It's about how you said it or what you said.
Sure.
And it's not getting anybody anywhere. And the only response to that when you undercut your argument is to get somebody like Trump who isn't afraid to fight dirty.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I think that that's definitely a accurate description of what is taking place. Unfortunately, I think that a casualty of that process has been any effort at argument, which you alluded to there.
Absolutely.
You know, the reason why political correctness is a threat, and it really is, it's a threat, is because it is aimed at, it is designed toward undermining argument.
I mean, some of it is the message is the, or the media is the message. The medium is the message. In that social media doesn't allow for the true talking of points like, say, radio even does.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have time here to advance our points. And, I mean, granted, it helps that there's not 50 liberals in the room screaming at us while we're making the points.
Right.
But
we can arrange that.
But in that, social media encourages a sort of like fast food dialogue,
mm-hmm.
in that we just, it's what's quick, what's going to get the likes, what is going to get the retweets, instead of what is actually going to, because people don't have an attention span to actually get to the point of what the issue really is.
Mm. There are people who do have time to get to the point who nonetheless seem to be coming to the wrong conclusions, and I have to scratch my head and wonder why. And again, you know, going to this question of, you know, all these sexual misconduct allegations that have taken place, I turn my attention once again to Roy Moore. This from Politico. Roy Moore's campaign appearance Monday night in Northeast Alabama, his first rally since his Senate campaign, was blown open by allegations of sexual impropriety and an assault involving teenagers, had the atmosphere of an old-fashioned religious tent revival. A Baptist preacher thanked God for Moore during an invocation and prayed, "May we win this battle against a lost and dying world." The head of the county Republican Party called the election a spiritual battle we're fighting. The candidate called for a return to morality and said America can become great again only by acknowledging God. The standing room audience frequently punctuated Moore's comments with amen. Continue to pray, Rich Hobson, a longtime Moore associate and his campaign chief of staff, said at the Henniger Community Center, a small square room that was packed with nearly 200 supporters. Obviously, prayer works. That's why we're here, Hobson said. Now, I find that last comment particularly interesting. As a Christian, as a religious guy myself, prayer works. Yeah, it does. But what's it for? Like, what does it work toward? What's the purpose of it? You know, whenever you hear, like, recently we had, we've had a number of shootings. We've had terrorist events that have taken place. You know, we've had hurricanes come through and provide trial and tribulation for communities throughout the nation. Whenever something like that happens, and increasingly you see a mockery of thoughts and prayers, right? You know, if somebody says, I'm going to pray for the folks down in Texas, or I'm going to pray for the folks down in Florida, that gets mocked by atheists, by folks on the left. And the idea being your prayers don't really do anything. Now, that's a straw man argument, because the unspoken premise is that that a prayer is basically like a spell, right? Like I'm conjuring up some sort of divine power to fix the problem.
I think the what they're getting at, because the first person that I heard it from was Anthony Jeselnik. He's a comedian, and he said that thoughts and prayers, yeah, it doesn't advance anything, but you're just making it about yourself. Like, hey, despite this tragedy, don't forget about me. That's what it's about. It's selfish.
I think there's probably a degree to which that's true with certain individual people. But I think more generally in the discourse, what's being driven at here is this idea. It's a misunderstanding of what prayer actually is. Prayer is not a spell meant to conjure some sort of supernatural power to fix a problem so that you don't have to. That's what's being offered when people speak mockingly of prayer. The purpose of prayer is to bring you, as the worshiper, in closer relationship with God. Now, in that context, I find it perplexing that ministers down in Alabama would think that the result of drawing closer to God is that you find yourself standing side by side with somebody who's been accused of molesting children. Because again, you know, as I spoke to about last week when I talked about the process that one goes through in order to obtain a position of authority within the church, being accused of what Roy Moore has been accused of would disqualify you from 9 out of 10 churches, I have to imagine, if you were being considered for something like deacon or elder or pastor or whatever the case may be. You wouldn't have to prove it in a court of law. You wouldn't have to, you know, end up having a judgment against you in civil court with a preponderance of evidence. The mere existence of the allegation and a nexus of circumstances that created a atmosphere of doubt about your character would be enough to disqualify you. Yet we're willing to elect somebody like that to the U.S. Senate. Odd. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Speaking of Roy Moore, you know, I've said on the program before that I tend to believe these accusations that have been made against him, not because, just because I choose to, right? Like, it's not a question of flipping a coin or, you know, out of some sort of political bias or anything along those lines, but because of the evidence itself, the preponderance of the evidence that has been presented, and also to a large degree, because this is what you have to rely upon, a subjective sense of the credibility of the story itself. Like when you actually listen to the gals give their account of what they experienced, and not just what they experienced, like the actual facts of it, but listen to them talk about how it has affected their lives, there is a credibility to that that is difficult for a non-professional actor to fake. It's hard. It's hard to lie. Can we acknowledge that? It's tough to tell a really convincing, comprehensive lie. Like, lies are best when they're simple and short and brief and can't really be vetted. And these accusations have been detailed. They've been comprehensive. You know, people have corroborated them and what have you. And that's, you know, a different approach or a different standard than, you know, oh, somebody said this secondhand in passing, and you can therefore dismiss it because it's not necessary. It's not particularly credible. An interesting example of how difficult it is to fake a story like this has presented itself, and I think it's worth our attention. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855, the number to join us, by the way. From the Washington Post, a woman who falsely claimed to the Washington Post that Roy Moore, the Republican U.S. Senate candidate in Alabama, impregnated her as a teenager, appears to work with an organization that uses deceptive tactics to secretly record conversations in an effort to embarrass its targets. In a series of interviews over 2 weeks, the woman shared a dramatic story about an alleged sexual relationship with Moore in 1992 that led to an abortion when she was 15. During the interviews, she repeatedly pressed Post reporters to give their opinions on the effects that her claims would have on Moore's candidacy if she went public. The Post did not publish an article based on her unsubstantiated account. When Post reporters confronted her with inconsistencies in her story and an internet posting that raised doubts about her motivations, she insisted that she was not working with any organization that targets journalists. But on Monday morning, Post reporters saw her walking into the New York offices of Project Veritas, an organization that targets the mainstream news media and left-leaning groups. The organization sets up undercover stings that involve using false cover stories and covert video recordings meant to expose what the group says is media bias. Now, let's acknowledge that Project Veritas and James O'Keefe, who runs it, they've done some very good work. They've exposed some things that properly ought to be exposed. They've picked up a lot of the slack that the media has dropped. You know, they remember when they destroyed Acorn? Acorn no longer exists because of James O'Keefe. You know, they exposed Planned Parenthood and the selling of baby parts. They exposed the bias of the editorial room at, I believe it was CNN, whatever the case may be. Like, they do good work. That said, what this demonstrates, this story, is that you can't just walk into a major newspaper like the Washington Post with an invented story about sexual misconduct against somebody running for office and expect it to be on the front page the next day. Because they do this thing called vetting. They do this thing called verifying, right? Research. They find out who you are. They talk to people who know you. They pursue leads until they have multiple sources and corroborations backing up a narrative. That's how these initial stories about the accusations involving Roy Moore were conjured. It wasn't because, and that's the other part of this, is that, and for some reason we seem to forget this when we're analyzing this from the right. It's not as though the initial batch of ladies walked into the offices of the Washington Post and said, I got a story to tell you. Like, that's not how this happened. What happened was a reporter was down in Alabama and was reporting on the campaign and started to hear rumors and pursued those leads and found the women and conjured the stories out of them, got them to go on the record with their stories, and then worked to corroborate those stories and then wrote the story. The reason why this Veritas thing didn't work is because they tried to approach it from the opposite perspective. Hey, I'm here to blow up Roy Moore's campaign. I got a great story for you. Can I be on the front page tomorrow? It was a little suspicious. And, you know, I'm afraid that it actually undermines this tactic. And again, I like James O'Keefe. I like Project Veritas. They've done some good work. But by doing this, they have undermined, first of all, their own credibility. They've undermined the argument that they were trying to make against the media. Because the whole point, the whole thing they were trying to do was to get the Washington Post to bite on this, right? And to run with it and then expose it as, oh, see, the media is so biased, they're going to run with anything. They have the first sniff they get of a story that's going to hurt a Republican, they run with it. And what they've demonstrated instead is that that's not true. That's not true. And so now the left is going to be able to counter with the argument of, see, the new, there's no such thing as fake news. The media is doing their job. They're totally fine. You can't get anything past the Washington Post, which is also a lie, right? Like, there is actual media bias. There is actual fake news that takes place in the mainstream media that properly ought to be addressed. And it's going to be more difficult to make that case now as a result of the tactic that Project Veritas and James O'Keefe chose to engage in here. Let's go to Corey in Bloomington real quick before we have to go to break. How's it going, Corey?
I'm pretty good.
What's on your mind tonight?
Yeah, I think he should stay in office.
Roy Moore? Well, he needs to get there first. That's kind of the question. But you don't think there's anything to the accusations?
I don't.
You don't know?
I don't think
so. Does it matter, though? I mean, if everything that's been said about him is true, should he still be a U.S. senator?
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. I appreciate your call, Corey, as always. And yeah, there's a fair number of people that obviously believe that. Lou, Sue, we'll get to you when we return. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM here 9 to 11 weeknights. 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. If you miss a show, you can catch up with our podcast right there in your iHeartRadio app. Just do a search for Closing Argument. Our channel will pop right up. You can check out all of our past programs. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. Brad Omlin taking your calls, producing the show. Let's go straight to those calls. We got Lou in Cross Lake, who's been holding for quite some time. Appreciate you doing so. What's on your mind tonight, sir?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Well, you've got a real good schedule, don't you? You come in a couple days a week. And
right? Well, that's all about to end because football's coming to a close. So we're going to be on the air much more often.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm envious, but... You know, another take on this whole, you know, you're talking about all the sex scandals and everything. And
yeah.
Are you familiar with the sexual revolution? Ever looked at it and when it started, or so-called? And
I probably know as much as the next guy, which, you know, isn't a great credit, but.
When do you know that it's starting?
The 50s. I guess.
Yeah, the pill came out about 1960.
Right.
And I don't have anything on me because I'm out of town, but I had some stuff that I had cut out years ago. A woman had written an article that was in the paper back
then. Right, yeah.
And in 1930, all birth control was, by all the Christian faiths, was banned. And it's interesting to note how much things have changed,
right,
in the last 80 years or so.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the 60s was really... Have you ever seen the movie... you've probably seen The Graduate.
You know, I actually never got around to it. I should.
And
I like both those actors.
Yeah, Dustin Hoffman's good, and yeah.
I can't think of her name off the top of my head, but
and Bancroft.
There you go. Yeah, she's fantastic. But anyway,
but those movies, just watching those movies, and then What's New Pussycat with Peter Sellers and Peter O'Toole,
mm-hmm,
about a guy who is having some psychological problems because he's got so many available women. And that's Peter O'Toole.
Uh-huh.
Peter Sellers is the shrink,
uh-huh,
who's working on him. And trying to help him out, and then he gets wrapped up in his patient's life because
right.
maybe kind of jealous or whatever. And
yeah, I mean, you're really cutting to the heart of the matter, Lou. And I talked about this quite a bit over the holiday, which is that, you know, to me, what's most interesting about all these sexual misconduct allegations and all the drama surrounding them is less the particulars of the accusations and the responses and the political fallout and all that, but how it is that we find ourselves in a culture where all this stuff has taken place. And I think you are pointing us in the direction of the answer to that question, which is that we now have a culture, a sexual culture, wherein, you know, we really only regard the negative consequences of any sort of consensual sexual activity as an unwanted pregnancy or a sexually transmitted disease. Like, those are the only two possible bad things that can happen as a result of an extramarital sexual encounter. When, in point of fact, that there was much more to those old fashioned biblical mandates regarding personal behavior than just making babies and getting sick.
Yeah, I think you're probably well versed on all this, and you know, but the birth control in 1960, the pill, and then of course the Roe v. Wade thing 13 years later,
mm-hmm.
and of course there was a lot of things going on. I knew a guy who, and of course the CIA had run studies on this or whatever, and actually it was almost like maybe it was a kind of a psyop.
Oh, are you talking about? I should have interrupted you until I actually knew who it was. Like Kinsley or something with a K? Maybe we're thinking of two different guys.
Well, no, I'm talking about a guy I know who he's gotten out of the business.
Oh, a guy you know. Okay, I got you.
But,
well, that's interesting.
Were you ever at the bars, like the disco bars? You were probably too young.
No, I wasn't even born yet. I came around in 78, so that was on its way out. So,
well, that did continue on. I mean, actually, the flashing lights, lights were kind of would cause dissociative disorder.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I mean, there's a lot of things I could get into. I'm not
sure
just to that one thing, but
the world ain't what it used to be. I appreciate your point, Lou. I do got to move on here, but I appreciate your point. It's true that we have undergone cultural changes that have an effect upon all of our lives and the environment in which we are raising our children. Sue in St. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi. I've got a couple comments about
Roy Moore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a couple thoughts I have. I mean, I don't really know, of course. Nobody really does.
Yeah.
But, and there is, you know, there is some smoke there. But one thing I think. He was 38, 40 years ago, and there has been nothing since then. And it was before he was married, you know. And I look at it this way. I mean, he had gone to West Point and then Vietnam. And then I suppose at law school, was he an attorney?
Mm-hmm.
And then he was apparently politically active because he got a political office. And then he was just kind of what that other gentleman was referring to. Maybe he wanted to look for love in all the wrong places, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
describing.
There's been no complaints since. You know, this was 30, 40 years. I can remember when I was that young. Well, I'm 71, so that was a little longer ago than that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you mentioned that the women said how it affected their lives. And I think, oh, crap, you know, I can't even remember their names, all the guys who gave it the old college try, you know. But they didn't get anywhere. But it's not that an emotional thing, you know?
Right. But I mean, we're talking
40 years later, you're going to be all in a tizzy about it. It's not like it was. I'm not saying it would be different if it were rape or a violent, you know.
But that's what we're talking about. That's the thing is you're kind of dancing around the heart of the issue. It's not just that, you know, he approached him and said, "Hey, how do you do? Would you like to go out sometime?" It was that he, according to the allegations, he engaged in what could be described as assaults, particularly involving underage girls. You know, one as young as 14 years old. That's not your typical back in the day story. Like that was there's never a point where that was acceptable behavior, even 40 years ago.
Well, you know, it seems to me the things they describe. I mean, did he know how old the 14-year-old was? And was any of this embellished or dramatized?
Well,
like I'm saying, I think this was a bit dramatic for all that long time ago. You know, you get over things. I mean, I've had terrible things, like everybody probably has.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to get all emotional and start crying about them when I have a conversation about it, you know. I think maybe they played it up and they kind of, could they have played it up and dredged out some emotion, the people who are questioning them. And
so, basically what you're saying is,
to you is how did they find these girls? There was no official complaints made.
No, there wasn't. No.
Or anything.
No.
How did they find them? Is that town small that sort of stuff would get around? I don't even remember those guys' names from years ago.
I hear you. But so according to the original article that the Washington Post put out, I believe it was the Washington Post that broke this story, they had a reporter down in Alabama who was working the story of the campaign. Like, he didn't go down there, I'm going to find me some sexual misconduct allegations. He was down there working on the campaign and caught wind of rumors, which, as we have subsequently learned, apparently there's a reputation that Roy Moore has had going back decades. I mean, you say that there haven't been any more recent accusations. You know, perhaps they haven't come forward, but what we can say is that there is reportedly this reputation that he has had over the years for being a guy that you probably don't want to let your daughters go next to, right? And, you know, what is that based off of? Are the people who live there making it up? You know, that's the thing, is I find it more difficult. You know, it's one thing to ask the question. It's a totally legitimate question to say, are the people who are saying, who are making these specific claims, are they embellishing? Are they making it up?
No, I'm not saying are they making it up necessarily, but is it being overly dramatized? I mean, the one lady goes in there with an attorney who is the most famous woman's attorney in the country.
Right.
How many small town people can have
that? Right. Who's paying that bill?
Did she have with this big shot attorney?
Sure. And that's where you get into the Project Veritas thing. I appreciate you calling, Sue, and contributing to the program tonight. That's where you get into this thing that Project Veritas just got caught doing, where they went into the Washington Post and they tried to sell a fake story of an accusation of Roy Moore raping a gal. Right. They knew it was fake. They conjured it up. They went in there to try to sell it in order to prove that the media is biased and that they're eager to latch on to any accusation without evidence, you know, even if it's not true, in order to try to affect the political outcome in the race. And the Post caught them and exposed them. And now that's a story. The problem with this notion that, you know, the stories are fake is that, in order for the story to be fake, you have to undermine the credibility of every corroborating piece of evidence. So you have to, it's not just the gal who comes in with her story. It's also her friend and her mother and, you know, the lawyers at the time who, you know, witnessed conversations or whatever the case may be. It's the person you're talking to down the street at the liquor store or the butcher shop who's telling you, oh yeah, there's a reputation this guy has of going around and doing this sort of thing. Like, what you're basically saying is that all of them are lying.
Well, it's like a few years ago, well, probably a decade ago now, when somebody walked up to Courtney Love at an award show and said, do you have any advice for somebody trying to make it in Hollywood? And she said, stay away from Harvey Weinstein. It's stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, anecdotes are a tough thing to fake. And I'm not talking about, like, a anecdote. I'm talking about a number of unconnected anecdotes which corroborate a general theme. That is a very difficult thing to try to manufacture, and it gets to the level of absurd to try to call it a conspiracy, you know, when what would be, there's no benefit to it. Like, why would you seed Why would you plant all of these seeds in order to harvest a conspiracy 40 years down the road just in case Roy Moore decides he's going to run for U.S. Senate someday? Believing that requires a suspension of disbelief above and beyond what it takes to just accept that the gal actually means what she says. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. It's hard to tell just how recent this is because, you know, I'm not actually looking at the actual post, but a picture of a post, and you never know when somebody took the picture. But apparently the proprietor of the Whiskey Junction, a bar in downtown Minneapolis, has announced that, and reading here from the post, after 12 great years of business, the Whiskey Junction will be closing its doors for good. Last day of business will be December 31st of this year. Unfortunately, after recent changes in the Minneapolis ordinances regarding minimum wages and primarily the lack of a tip credit provision, we feel now is the time to get out of the bar business. We fought for our voice to explain how minimum wage without a tip credit will be detrimental to the small bar and restaurant owners of Minneapolis, but we were not listened to. Therefore, it's on to the next adventure. And they go on to thank their staff and customers just before they close their doors. Well, that is one of the most predictable outcomes that you could possibly imagine. And no doubt there, I haven't seen the comments on this post, but I got to imagine they're being demonized as greedy capitalists for, you know, deciding that. Because, you know, here's a question for your consideration here on Closing Argument with me, Walter Hudson. Why is the Whiskey Junction, why does it exist? Why does any bar or restaurant or business exist? Does it exist primarily to provide you with whatever it is you get there? Like, does your grocery store exist because you need food and because it's performing a dutiful obligation to provide you with that food? Or does it exist because the proprietor has this sense that if they meet a need in trade, they will actually be able to profit and thereby pursue their own values, pursue their own happiness, make their own living, get what they need. Mutual benefit. That's what's required for trade to take place. And this is, you know, again, when we were talking last hour about the whole Lake Calhoun, the Hennepin County Board has decided they're going to change the name of Lake Calhoun to, you know, meep or something, some original Dakota name, however it's pronounced.
Walter, you just did what Donald Trump did.
Yeah, but I'm on the radio at 10:30 at night. If I was standing in a room full of Dakota, and the purpose of the gathering was, we're here to recognize the great contributions that the Dakota have made, and I made the meep thing, yes, I would be doing what Donald Trump did.
It's like, I remember, was it Scary Movie 3?
Where the president, I don't think I watched that one.
The president is speaking to the Native American people in the back of the room, and he goes, and we have the natives here. Hey, how are ya?
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. And again, it goes to time, place, manner. And that's what I said at the outset, I don't have a problem with Trump using Pocahontas as an epithet against Elizabeth Warren in the context of he's out on the campaign trail making fun of her for faking her heritage. That's totally fine. But, you know, the idea that you're going to do it in the specific context that he did, that's a different question. Anyway, so the Hennepin County Board made this decision that they were going to change the name, and what they can't do through that act, what they don't accomplish by having that vote, is actually changing how you think about Lake Calhoun. To you, Lake Calhoun is Lake Calhoun, and it always will be Lake Calhoun. And no matter how long it's named Bada Scotta May or whatever it is, the name that they came up with or that they conjured from history, no matter how long it's officially that name, you're going to call it Lake Calhoun because that's what you know it as. In a similar sense, when the Minneapolis City Council decides they're going to set the minimum wage to $15 an hour without a tip credit, and that's just automatically going to make everybody's lives better, they can't, what they can't change through the force of law, what they can't change through an act of the city council is economic reality. They can't change the fact that the only reason why anybody produces anything at all is because it's of benefit to them. The only reason that anybody engages in trade of any kind is because it's of benefit to them. Mutual benefit. That's what capitalism enables. And to the extent you interfere with that, you are interfering with the human capacity to survive and thrive. And there's something deeply immoral about that. Let's go to Rob in Elk River. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Thanks for getting my call first time. And love the show, by the way, for listening.
Thanks.
You know, what you said about Whiskey Junction, I'm going to laugh because I'm a businessman in South Minneapolis. I think there's a couple double-edged swords. I think we get pigeonholed with a tip credit because I am in the hospitality industry. And people need to realize it's not just the tip credit that is the issue. It's the wage in general.
Sure.
And if you don't pay attention, you're 100% right. Minimum wage in the state of Minnesota was $7.50, it's now $9.50. But let's just say it's $10 for mathematics. Mm-hmm. That's a 25% increase. But a double hamburger at McDonald's is no longer 99 cents. It's $1.59 to $1.79.
Right.
Well, you gave a 20% increase on food that now costs 59 to 79% more money.
Mm-hmm.
Who did you help? Because the guy making $20 an hour didn't get a raise, making less money. And if you think it's just food, look at anything we're purchasing nowadays. Health insurance.
Yep.
A takeout yogurt cup at Holiday just went up 50 cents from $2.49 to
$2.99.
Right. You're 100% right. Throwing money at people does not solve the situation.
Right.
Now, people are concerned about the $15 an hour, but if you can hire somebody in this day and age for less than 12 or 14 bucks an hour, even in the hospitality industry, let alone service or anything else, I don't know where you're hiring them from.
Sure. Right. Yeah, well, no, you're absolutely right, and I appreciate your call, Rob. Like, I remember when I was when I first started working, and I can't believe I'm about to share this on the air because it's not something to be proud of. When I first started working and first started earning money of my own, I used to think of value in terms of Whoppers from Burger King, because at the time you could get a full size Whopper for 99 cents for a dollar basically. And so, you know, if I was looking at purchasing something that cost $20, I'd think to myself, is that worth more than 20 Whoppers? I don't know. That's how I would balance it out in my head. I would make my purchasing decisions based upon how many Whoppers I could buy with the same amount of money.
You must really like Whoppers.
I really like Whoppers.
Burger King, we're open to sponsorships.
Yeah, right. Times have changed, okay? My tastes have evolved, but yeah, in the day, that's what it was. And the math is all wrong now. Like, to his point, you can't apply that same equation. It's not gonna factor out the same because the price of everything has gone up. All right, I think we got just enough time to squeeze in Anthony here from St. Paul. Appreciate you calling in. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I'm pretty much just going to – I just turned on the radio, heard you guys. I was like, oh, hey, I should call in Bug Walter. I heard
sure.
you guys talk about Trump and Elizabeth Warren. And,
yeah.
I just – something I've come to realize is there's some people on the right and there's some people on the left, both of what having in common is they just don't understand Trump. Like, the reason that people like me and the blue-collar workers like Trump so much is because he does stuff like that. Like, we think it's funny. We think it's, why doesn't every president do that? Why can't he just be, you know, himself? Like, he doesn't have to be a polished turd like Obama was.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I feel like if more people were like Trump, I think the closest one that could compare is Reagan in terms of just like his jokes and how funny he is, I think. But there's just some people that don't get that. They just think, you know, like, you know, that's not okay for a president, or, you know, there's a time and a place. But what it really does is it serves a double purpose. Is it really bothers, on top of the fact you get this fan base, it really makes the media look stupid. Like, he's trying to say that calling her Pocahontas is a racial slur. Like, they're like, pretty soon they're going to have to cover for her so she doesn't get taken out by that other Indian guy that's running against her.
Yeah, I mean, see, now you're going to force me to go over a little bit because I need to explore this. I really need to try to understand this. So I'm going to accept your premise that, because I'm one of these folks who's critical of the president for having done this in this time, place, and manner. I don't understand it, and I would like to. I genuinely would, because to an extent, I get what you're saying. Like, the whole I'm sick and tired of, and we talked about this pretty extensively last hour, but I still don't get it, right? This whole notion, this
thing in, because I know I don't know how much time I have. I'm sorry for cutting you off.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I just want to let you know it's okay, man. You know, not everybody gets it. I'm not saying that's not a detriment.
Right.
Okay. There's just some people that weren't raised that way, and that's okay. It's okay. You don't gotta. You're not gonna. If you don't understand it at this point, I don't see. I don't really see you getting into the mind of like someone like me or someone like Jim down the road that voted for Trump specifically because of stuff like this. It just won't make sense to you. The best I can do is try to explain it like that, and we just like it. We just think it's funny. We don't see it very often, like from anybody, you know. And that's all. I'm sorry for cutting you off.
No. I appreciate your candor and, as always, your willingness to call in and give us that perspective and keep doing it. We'll talk to you later in the week, I'm sure.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Anthony.
He's saying that he's esoteric, basically, that it's understood not to be understood by many.
Yeah, I guess.
Like, that's the same approach, like, Common Man on KFAN has. Mm-hmm. Like, he's esoteric. Like, you don't know quite whether he's joking or whether he's being serious. Mm-hmm. But, like, if you get it, you think he's funny.
See, to me, it credits Trump with a level of cognition and strategy and thought that just is not there.
Well,
like, the idea that the reason he brought up Pocahontas at this event was to troll the media and to have some sort of profound demonstration of the absurdity of different, like, that's not why he did it. He did it in a stream of consciousness because it occurred to him, and he just decided he was going to take this opportunity. Hey, I'm surrounded by Native Americans. That reminds me of the time I talked about this gal named Pocahontas. You know, like, and there's no there. It's to me what's annoying less than the whole time, place, manner thing is that there doesn't seem to be a thought process behind it.
He's doing it for his own entertainment.
Well, and maybe that's the thing that Anthony appreciates. I don't know. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. One thing that you see an awful lot of on social media is people lamenting the place which all these stories, allegations of sexual misconduct and, you know, drama over the Navajo Code Talkers and Trump's evoking of Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas, the fact that these stories displace consideration of actual policy. And there's an extent to which that's a legitimate complaint, right? Like, there is the consideration of things that really matter, the things that matter in the long term, is certainly displaced by these sort of more, you know, shall we say, tabloid-esque controversies that pop up. At the same time, I do not think that it's a waste of time to talk about, I mean, obviously, we've talked about it quite a bit tonight, to talk about the sexual misconduct allegations or to talk about, you know, whether or not it's appropriate to consider time, place, and manner, you know, before you say something, you know, like Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas at a Navajo Code Talker recognition event or whatever the case may be. There's value there. But we do need to keep our eye on the ball in terms of policy. And so I want to turn to that now as we consider the Republicans' efforts to advance their idea of tax reform. This is Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream us, 651-989-5855, the number to join the program. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. So I got two stories here, one that was written before the other, and I'm going to go with the one, I'm going to start off here with the one that's a little bit out of date, because it kind of sets the stage for the context in which this discussion in Washington has been taking place amongst Republicans over tax reform. This comes to us from Axios. With the Senate aiming for a tax vote late this week, White House and Senate aides express constant behind-the-scenes concern about three senators who are A, worried about the deficit, B, wholly unbeholden to leadership, and C, relish the opportunity to snub President Trump. Senators John McCain, Bob Corker, and Jeff Flake all despise Trump and aren't likely to face voters again. Senate leaders recently added a new name to the problem list, Senator Steve Daines of Montana. He hasn't gone public with his concerns, but is withholding his support for the bill because he believes it favors corporations over other types of businesses. Other holdouts who are being lobbied, Susan Collins and Ron Johnson. Collins has constituents who love it when she bucks the party line. Washington Post just posted a good piece on changes being considered to win over holdouts. It matters because if the Republicans lose any three of these six who are considered potential issues, several others could move together. The tax cuts are dead. The bottom line is that GOP leaders hoped to lock all of these folks down before Thanksgiving, but that didn't work. Leadership doesn't yet have 50 votes. The consensus view is that Susan Collins, wants to get to a yes, and Daines could jump Johnson to get on board since we have similar concerns. Now, before we move forward to considering the more recent article that gets into the progress that's been made here on tax reform, I just want to spend a minute or two considering these different reasons why various senators are holdouts on tax reform. Now, you know, point C that's offered here, relishing the opportunity to snub President Trump, that is a wholly illegitimate reason. Like, nothing irks me more than making policy decisions that have an effect on people's actual lives based on personal animus or, you know, some sort of concern that has nothing whatsoever to do with the policy itself. And the idea that you're going to vote against tax reform just to deprive President Trump of an accomplishment is pretty obscene. It's pretty obscene. So that's a completely unlegitimate or illegitimate reason to be withholding support for this bill. The idea, however, that's first noted here, that's informing some of these senators, that they're worried about the deficit, that is entirely legitimate. And indeed, they should be. Somebody needs to be. Somebody needs to be worried about the $20 trillion of national debt that we currently have, that it's on its way up, and that will continue to go up if we expand or even just maintain the deficit. Somebody needs to be concerned about that. And the idea that if we're going to engage in tax reform, we ought to do so in a manner that at the very least doesn't grow the deficit and, you know, God forbid, actually shrinks it, is a pretty legitimate concern. That's an actual policy concern. And so that's something that I would like to see considered. Now, unfortunately, progress has been made on this thing, and I'm not too keen on how that progress is being made. From Politico, Senate Republicans got some sorely needed momentum behind their tax overhaul Tuesday as key GOP swing votes inched closer to backing the legislation after Senate leaders launched a frenzied round of negotiations to convince the holdouts. The Senate Budget Committee voted to advance the GOP tax reform bill on Tuesday on a party-line vote with both Senators Bob Corker and Ron Johnson, both of whom were mentioned in the previous article as holdouts, backing the measure a day after threatening to withhold their support. That critical vote came after President Donald Trump came to the Capitol Hill to rally the troops in the tax battle. Johnson voted for the tax bill after a back-and-forth with Trump during the lunch, according to multiple sources, over the Wisconsin Republicans' main concern that current proposal gives more benefits to corporations than to businesses that pay taxes through the individual system. Now, again, that is a policy concern. It is therefore entirely legitimate to have to withhold your support on policy based upon the content of that policy. At one point, continuing here at Politico, Johnson, who has persistently pressed his case for so-called pass-throughs to other senators, said jokingly that no one grandstands better than him, according to one senator who attended the lunch. Corker, one of the fiscal hawks concerned about the deficit impact of tax cuts, said he was satisfied with details for a trigger to reverse tax cuts if economic growth fell short of projections in years to come. Now, let me rephrase that for you. He's talking about automatic tax hikes. Automatic tax hikes built into the bill being advanced by your elected Republicans. What? We'll get into it a little bit when we come back. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So as as we were going into the break, we were tripping upon this small little detail in the negotiations taking place in Washington, D.C. amongst Republicans regarding their plan to reform the tax code. This little thing tucked in there that you might not have noticed if you were just reading the article casually. And that is that in an effort to get some buy-in from some holdouts, senator deficit hawks, as they're described, senators who are concerned that the tax plan as originally drafted is going to contribute to the deficit, make it bigger, and therefore increase the national debt. The solution that they've come up with for this problem is to embed automatic tax increases into the bill. A Republican bill. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. From the Star Tribune. Senate Republicans are considering a trigger that would automatically increase taxes if their sweeping legislation fails to generate as much revenue as they expect. It's an effort to mollify deficit hawks who worry that tax cuts for businesses and individuals will add to the nation's already mounting debt. The effort comes as a second Republican Senator Steve Daines of Montana announced Monday that he opposes the tax bill in its current form. Previously, Senator Ron Johnson said he opposed the bill, leaving Senate Republicans no room for error as they hope to vote on the bill this week. Now, this is an article, I believe, from yesterday. Yes. And since then, Ron Johnson has come around as a result of this provision that there's going to be automatic tax increases. Now, Xavier Bickett, friend of the show, asks on social media when somebody, you know, posted this story, the obvious question, what about all caps automatic spending cuts? That strikes me as a viable solution, right? Like, why isn't the conservative solution to the problem? If we have a problem whereby we're going to end up blowing up the deficit because of decreased taxes, let's have in across the board, you know, do you already have the model for it in the, what do they call those, sequester? Is that right? Where they did like the percentage cut in federal spending?
Yeah.
Yeah. The sequester. Just do that. Like, I think that's kind of a cop out in that you're not actually going through and determining the value of particular line items. You're just saying, oh, across the board, we're going to cut a percentage. But I would rather have that automatic than to say, oh, we're going to raise taxes if there's a deficit problem. Because, you know, you're really kind of conceding a point from the other side, which is that the way to fix deficits is to increase taxes. It's a view of the taxpayer that they're just a money tree that you can shake in order to get more, in order to cover whatever deficit you have. It's like, no, like that money has to come from somewhere. And perhaps if there's a deficit, it's the forces of supply and demand signaling something to you about your behavior. Maybe you should adjust your spending. I mean, that's what it means in my world. You know, when I find out that there's a deficit, when there's more going out than there is coming in, it signals to me that I need to change what's going out. Right? You know, I mean, it seems pretty clear to me, but apparently it's not clear to your elected Republicans. All right. So I wanted to contrast a couple of things here. This first thing comes to us from USA Today. Black Africans are being sold in open-air slave markets, and it's Hillary Clinton's fault. But you won't hear much about that from the news media or the foreign policy pundits. Footage from Libya released recently by CNN showed young men from sub-Saharan Africa being auctioned off as farm workers in slave markets. How did we get to this point? As the BBC reported back in May, Libya has been beset by chaos since NATO-backed forces overthrew long-serving ruler Colonel Muammar Gaddafi in October 2011. And it goes on to, you know, blame Hillary Clinton and foreign policy. Now, the point that I want to get out of this is the notion that when we talk about slavery, and particularly when the left talks about slavery, it's always very specifically historic chattel slavery in the United States committed by white people against black people, you know, 100 years ago or more, right? Like it's as if that's the only context in which slavery has ever happened, right? And yet today in the year 2017, in the future, right? In the year 2017, we don't have flying cars. We don't have hoverboards, but we do have black slavery. And it doesn't seem to be a problem on the minds of the Hillary Clintons of the world. It doesn't seem to be a problem on the minds of the Bernie Sanders of the world. They're more concerned about pursuing a $15 an hour minimum wage than they are about actually dealing with the deprivation of human liberty elsewhere in the globe, right? That's point number one on this. Contrast that with what does occupy the minds and occupy the attention of elected Democrats. This from the Star Tribune. The federal agency that regulates nursing homes must take more aggressive steps to prevent and respond to violent crimes and other forms of abuse in senior care facilities, U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar said Tuesday. In a letter to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Minnesota Democrat cited a five-day Star Tribune special report published this month that detailed repeated failures by regulators to investigate incidents of criminal abuse in senior care homes across Minnesota. The report found that hundreds of vulnerable residents at senior care centers are beaten, sexually assaulted, or robbed each year. Yet the vast majority of these incidents are never investigated, and the perpetrators typically go unpunished. The series also highlighted how abuse victims and their families are often kept in the dark for months or even years as state investigations drag on indefinitely and facilities keep the incidents secret. Now, a couple of points on this. Number one, you know, is Amy Klobuchar, generally speaking, is any given human being correct to be concerned about the findings of the Star Tribune story? Absolutely. Of course. All right. Like, we should all be concerned about any human being under any circumstances being abused. But as a political gesture, this strikes me as yet another example of Amy Klobuchar picking the lowest possible hanging fruit, picking an issue on which literally everyone in the world is on one side of, right? Like, who's the person who's for abusing old people? Like, find that constituency, right? Like, it does not exist. There is nobody on the other side. She's not taking any risk by staking out this position of we ought to do something to protect the elderly, right? That's point number one. Point number two is, why does this need to be done at the federal level? Like government properly does serve this role, right? Like, the reason why we have government is to provide and ensure and maintain the condition of liberty. Obviously, if you're being robbed and beaten and abused, you are not living in the condition of liberty. And government's role is to retaliate against that initiation of force against you. And so that needs to take place. But the police power is properly vested in the states. We don't need Amy Klobuchar to put on her superhero cape and fly in from the federal government and save the day. The states are more than capable of handling this. I think we here in Minnesota have enough concern about our grandmothers and our mothers and our aunts and our uncles. I think we have enough human concern for them to take care of the problem on our own. We don't need Amy Klobuchar to do it for us. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 9 to 11 weeknights here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.